It is May 18th, 2023. The Colorado Rockies are 19-25, fifth in the NL West, 9 games back of first place in the division, 4 games back of the final wild card playoff spot. A flurry of roster moves were made over the week. And also, let's discuss Connor Siebold, Peter Lambert, Jake Bird, Randall Grichuk, and Ryan McMahon. Welcome to Adjusting for Altitude.
Baseball is a difficult game. The average hitter gets on base in less than 40% of their plate appearances, yet the average pitcher gives up 4 runs every 9 innings pitched. The sport is a challenge on its own, but in altitude, the problems for baseball players compound. Less break on pitches, balls that fly significantly farther than at sea level, and then after playing in such a treacherous environment, the players play in normality for half of their regular season. Adjustments must be made by those who don the purple pinstripes of the Colorado Rockies. We discuss those adjustments here. This is Adjusting for Altitude with baseball fanatic and aspiring MLB general manager, Christopher Nelson II.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever or whenever you're listening to this. Welcome to Adjusting for Altitude, breaking down the unique challenges and difficulties faced by the only MLB team that plays a mile above sea level, streaming on all podcasting platforms across the World Wide Web. I am your host, Christopher Nelson II. As per usual, lots to look forward to on this episode, but last week we discussed the contributions of Kyle Freeland, Austin Gomber, Brad Hand, Jurickson Profar, and Brenton Doyle so far in 2023. How about that Brenton Doyle, by the way? That kid is absolutely just tearing it up. I know on last week's episode, just spoiler alert, I called him a future superstar, which I do indeed believe he is, but that kid, he's taking it to another level, to say the least. If you want to hear my analysis of those guys' performance thus far this season, go ahead and listen to last week's episode. But also, if you don't follow me over on social media, go ahead and do that as well over on Instagram. That's the one I use the most, and I think this is my username across all other platforms as well. It is I Am The Second, IamThaSecond. But with that, how are we doing this week, ladies and gentlemen? The Rockies continue to play very, very solid baseball, all things considered. The pitching hasn't always been the most consistent, neither has the hitting, but it seems like over the last week or so, they've kind of worked in tandem with each other, and the hitting has been good enough to carry on days where the pitching hasn't been the greatest, and vice versa. All in all, it was a solid week for the Rockies. You know, they dropped the series against the Phillies at home over the weekend, took 1 of the 3-game set, but they bounced back nicely against the Reds to open up this week, taking 2 of 3 from that club. All in all, that was probably not the biggest news over the week, because there were a lot of injuries sustained by this Rockies squad over the last 6 or 7 days since we last recorded. Let's talk about a few of them.
The Colorado Rockies are a Major League Baseball organization with many happenings and occurrences. Chris, what's been going on?
All right. So we were on last week's episode concerned about the status of Antonio Senzatella after he left his start against the Pirates last Wednesday with some sort of arm injury. And it was later clarified that he does have a UCL sprain, and as a result, he will be placed, or already has been placed, on the 15-day IL. But it's a little bit worse than that, because when you're dealing with the ulnar collateral ligament, that's always danger territory. Like, the alert bells start ringing, especially when we're talking about pitchers. So it's likely that Senzatella is going to miss at least a few months. He's not going to be in the rotation likely until later in the summer. If everything goes according to plan, maybe that's a little bit sooner, but it looks like that's what he's on pace for at this moment in time. As a result, the Rockies decided to hit the waiver wire. They picked up veteran Chase Anderson off of waivers from the Tampa Bay Rays. So far this season, Anderson hasn't seen a ton of time for the Tampa Bay Rays, obviously the best team in Major League Baseball thus far in the season. Only threw about 5 innings for him thus far this season. He was all right. He walked a batter, struck out 2, like not a super big sample size to pick and choose from when we're talking about a guy's effectiveness. But all in all, He's a solid veteran, and you can't complain about a veteran entering your rotation. I think he has something like a 38% ground ball rate, which is not too shabby, especially when we're talking pitchers coming to pitch at Coors Field. Made his first start for the Rockies this Tuesday against the Reds. Threw five innings, was pretty solid again, 3 strikeouts, 1 walk. I think that'll be a pretty solid placeholder for the Rockies in this rotation until they get healthy. And if he continues to pitch well, he might just find himself with a rotation spot for the rest of the year, kind of like Jose Ureña did for the team last season. But Senzatela was not the only starter to be placed on the 15-day IL. Ryan Feltner, unfortunately, was also placed on the 15-day IL this week after he sustained a skull fracture in the loss to the Phillies on Saturday evening. Took a line drive right off the dome from Nick Castellanos. That's always a concern. He was taken to the hospital, but nothing super major. He'll probably be out for a little while as well. And CJ Cron was placed on the 10-day IL with back muscle spasms, kind of hit, I think it was a weak pop fly somewhere in the outfield. And as he was jogging up the first base line, he just kind of stopped running. And for a second there, you might have thought he pulled something. All in all, it didn't end up being the case. He ended up having back spasms, and he'll probably be on the IL for a little bit. The last guy who was placed on the IL over the week was Nick Mears, a little bit more of a lesser-known name amongst probably the casual Rockies fan. But Nick Mears was a guy that the Rockies picked up off of waivers from the Rangers over the offseason. He's been pretty solid so far for them in his limited time. He's only thrown 6 innings for the major league club thus far this season. He has an ERA of 3. He's walked 4, struck out 8. All in all, ERA plus of 174. The Rockies seem to like him. He has a big fastball, upper 90s, pretty good curveball. So it'll be interesting to see how he develops. But he was also placed on the 15-day IL this week with a left oblique strain. And in response to all of these injuries that occurred, the Rockies were forced to dig into that depth a little bit. That depth that we talked about on the season preview episode that was likely going to be tapped into. Obviously, you didn't want to have to tap into it within the first month and a half of the season. But, I mean, it's baseball. That happens. Major league teams have to be prepared to do so. So, in response to all these injuries, the Colorado Rockies made some promotions. The first most notable promotion that they made was promoting Carl Kauffman to the major league club. Carl Kauffman was indeed slated to start for Albuquerque, I believe, sometime this week, but he was scratched from that start. He will actually be starting tomorrow night, Friday evening, against the Texas Rangers here at Coors Field. Carl Kauffman is a guy that the Colorado Rockies have liked for a while. They drafted him back in 2019 in the second round out of Michigan. He's a guy they tend to like. I don't know a ton about Carl Kauffman, but I think, if I'm not mistaken, at one point in time, he was in the top 30 prospects for the Colorado Rockies within the organization. Thus far this season at Albuquerque, he hasn't been the most impressive of starters. He's 2-3 with a 7.78 ERA in 37 innings pitched. And he's walked 12, struck out 26, giving up a batting average against of .340. So all in all, hasn't been great. But, you know, he's probably, I've heard from several sources that he is the most major league ready arm at AAA that the Rockies currently have. So he'll get his shot this Friday to see if he can make an impact in this rotation that has been absolutely injury ravaged. Another promotion that was made earlier in the week was the promotion of Riley Pint. Riley Pint has a very crazy story. If you haven't heard the story of Riley Pint, he was originally a first-round pick of the Colorado Rockies way back in 2016 out of high school. I think it was a high school in Kansas. Dude was throwing 100 miles an hour as a senior, and the Colorado Rockies looked up, and I believe they had the fourth overall pick in that draft, and they were like, yeah, high schooler throws 100 miles an hour. I think we can work with that. So they drafted Riley like fourth overall, gave him a decently large signing bonus. Plenty of money. It was like 1.4 million or something like that, 1.8. And he just never really panned out. He dealt with some injuries over the course of his initial few years in minor league baseball. Ended up retiring in 2021, I think it was. Came back from retirement, and he's been pretty solid since coming back from retirement. This season, he hasn't been amazing at Albuquerque. He's 0-1 with a 7.41 ERA, 16 walks to 24 strikeouts. I don't really honestly know why they promoted him to the major league squad, but he was the corresponding move for the Carl Kauffman promotion. So they promoted Pint earlier in the week he made his major league debut, actually, in the game against the Reds yesterday afternoon. Couldn't get through his inning. He struggled a little bit with command of his fastball and his slider, his two main pitches. Didn't make it through the inning. Pierce Johnson came in to shut the game down in the ninth, and he was demoted, I believe, either yesterday or today, as of me recording this, for Carl Kaufman, so that he could make his major league debut and first start on Friday. Michael Toglia was also promoted from AAA. And the thing with Toglia has been very highly hyped for a while. 11th overall prospect in the Rockies organization. So there's a lot to like there. He's a guy who's played a lot of first base. He's played a little bit of corner outfield. So it'll be interesting to see how the Rockies use him. He's obviously the corresponding move for CJ Cron. So he's likely going to play a lot of first base while CJ's on the injured list. So far this season in the minors, which is pretty much just been AAA, since that's where he's played thus far in 2023, Michael is slashing .257 with a .364 on base percentage, .857 OPS, 8 home runs and 33 RBIs thus far in the minor league season, 23 walks earned to 48 strikeouts. So very, very solid hitter so far to start the season is Michael. I think he's already gotten a few starts with the major league club so far since his promotion. He got a few in that Red Series. He looked all right. So it'll be interesting to see how his playing time develops over the next few weeks, with CJ likely to be out for at least the next week and a half with those spasms. The last promotion from AAA that the Rockies made was for Fernando Abad, veteran reliever. He's 37 years old. He's a guy the Rockies signed to a minor league contract before spring training began, just for reliever depth. And they tapped into it indeed when Mears got hurt by promoting Abad. I think Abad pitched like 0.2 innings or something like that earlier in the week. Might have been against the Reds as well. But, you know, he got out of the inning pretty solid. He's a guy who's not going to give you a ton of velocity at this stage in his career. But all things considered, he's been a 109 ERA plus kind of reliever over the course of his major league career. 9 percentage points better than the average major league pitcher. So there's a lot to like about Abad as a veteran reliever who can go into a game and get you outs most of the time. That's about it. And in terms of the roster moves that were made by the club this week, how about we dive into some five-man analysis?
Using advanced MLB analytics and eye test comparisons, let's discuss the performance of five Colorado Rockies thus far this season. This is five-man analysis.
All right, so we've got a fun five guys to break down on today's episode, the first of which, Mr. Connor Siebold. Now, Connor Siebold was brought over in a trade with the Boston Red Sox over the offseason. The Colorado Rockies were looking for some pitching depth, as I mentioned earlier, with the signing of Abad to a minor league contract in the offseason. They were also looking for it in the department of starting pitching, and that's exactly what Connor Siebold presents as a more inexperienced, a little bit younger type of starter that was likely going to start the year at AAA, but started the season with the major league club out of the gate, I believe. Overall, Siebold at this point in the season has kind of found himself in the third starter spot, just given the variability of the starting rotation, given the injuries to Herman being out for the season, obviously. Noah Davis, who was showing some promise, going on the injured list with some elbow inflammation. Just all things considered, with a rotation now that consists of Kyle Freeland, Austin Gomber, Chase Anderson, Siebold, and likely now Carl Kaufman, I'd say, based on hierarchy, that puts Siebold right around the third starter in this rotation. So Siebold's current role is as a third starter. So far this season, I don't think he's quite pitched up to it. Even though he's pitched better as of late, his stats for the season are as such. He's 1-0 with a 5.14 ERA, 28 innings pitched. He's walked 9 batters, struck out 20, good for a 97 ERA plus, a 5.13 FIP, and a 1.61 WHIP. So let's go take a look at Connor Siebold's percentile distribution thus far this season. So far, he's in the blue in a lot of categories. Average exit velo is below major league average. Expected ERA, expected weighted on base, expected batting average against, expected slugging, all in the blue, below major league average. His strikeout rate is in the 11th percentile. Whiff percentage is in the 13th percentile. Chase rate is in the 7th percentile. And overall, you wouldn't look at this and say, yeah, that's a good pitcher. However, he is in the red in a few categories. His hard hit percentage is 63rd percentile. Barrel percentage is 68th percentile. And his walk rate is in the 68th percentile. So there are some pros, some cons to Connor Siebold thus far this season. Let's go take a look at his pitch distribution. So far on the season, Connor is working with a four-pitch mix, four-seam fastball, slider, changeup, and curveball. The four-seam is thrown about 56% of the time at 93 miles an hour. The slider is thrown 32% of the time at 85 miles an hour. The changeup is thrown 10% of the time at 81 miles an hour. And the curveball is thrown 2% of the time at 79 miles per hour. Overall, I think the consensus on Siebold is that he's going to be a below average pitcher for this club this season, unless a few things turn around in his favor. But overall, I think he finds himself in a very unfortunate situation. So far, he finds that his fastball is his best pitch, but his curveball has the potential to be his best pitch. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, what I mean is that so far on the season, his batting average against on the four seam is 300 with an expected batting average against of 249. So his fastball is actually not being as good as it should be. And his curveball is almost the exact opposite. Now, he's only thrown eight curveballs thus far this season, and the batting average against on his curveball is 333. But that pitch has an expected batting average of 105. 105. Against his curveball, and he's really not throwing it, which is really disappointing to see. On top of that, the two secondary pitches that he is throwing the most, his slider and his changeup, are really not playing up to their potential. His slider in particular isn't playing up to its potential, and his changeup has been very ineffective. His slider has an expected batting average of 247. Currently, the batting average against is at 308, and all in all, it just hasn't been very effective. He's given up the most home runs he's given up four home runs total, I should say, but of the four home runs he's surrendered this season, three of them have come on the slider. In terms of the changeup was the pitch that really kind of sold the Rockies front office and staff in general on trading for Siebold for depth. The changeup was a pitch that they felt was his plus secondary pitch, and that obviously plays well at Coors Field. Unfortunately, his changeup thus far this season has a batting average against of 417 and an expected batting average of 375, which isn't much better. So all in all, like I said, Siebold finds himself in a very unfortunate situation, which is why the overall consensus is that he is a below average pitcher. And the eye test would kind of go along with that consensus. Overall, he throws fastballs in all circumstances. He doesn't seem like he has a particular way that he wants to work hitters more often than not. He kind of just balances it overall. But he does have 12 strikeouts. 12 of his 20 strikeouts on the season are on the four-seam fastball. So he does seem to like to use that pitch a lot. And I can recall distinct moments where I've seen him get strikeouts on that fastball. Unfortunately, he doesn't get to set that fastball up in two strike counts a lot because his slider, which is his second most used pitch, is often mislocated, like very frequently mislocated. And it's really hard for him to set up that fastball in those two strike counts when he can't use those secondary pitches in order to set up that difference and make that fastball effective. Overall, I'm really surprised to see that his curveball is hardly thrown. Like, I've seen a few of Connor's starts this season, and I really can't recall him throwing that curveball a lot. Obviously, I'm correct in that he's only thrown eight, but it just feels like that curveball is not having an effect in his arsenal. And I really do think a major adjustment he could make in order to be more effective is to throw that curveball more. Like, the expected batting average against, again, I know it's a small sample size, eight pitches, 105 batting average against is really darn good. It's better than all his other pitches, expected batting average. So I think if Connor took a page out of Kyle's book, Kyle Freeland, and made that curveball more of his primary breaking pitch, he might see a little bit more success. And this is kind of what you have to do if you're a starter who doesn't really fit the mold of a guy who can succeed at Coors Field in the long term, based on my evaluation, of course. Again, this is the evaluation we use to decide on this podcast whether a pitcher can be successful at Coors Field or not in the long term over the course of a season or multiple seasons. Obviously, there are very, very, very specific circumstances under which this ideal build is not necessary for a player to succeed. Obviously, Brent Suter would be a very good example of that. He's been like one of the best relievers in Major League Baseball, and he throws an 87 mile an hour fastball, which I'm going to tell you right now up front is not the ideal for a guy who can succeed at Coors Field long term. But he's found success with it, and we've discussed Brent in the past. Overall, his funky motion, his solid changeup, and the differential in speeds between his changeup and his fastball is very effective, to the point where he gets swings and foul tips, like weak foul tips on fastballs thrown down the middle. So guys like Brent Suter, who are very unique, can thrive even though they don't fit the ideal Coors Field pitcher mold. But all in all, again, this is the mold. A guy who hangs between 94 and 97 miles an hour on the fastball, with the fastball spin rate somewhere between 2,000 and 2,200 RPMs, since the major league average is right about 2,270. And he wants to throw that fastball about 55% of the time. The slider ideally should be between 86 and 89 miles per hour, with a spin rate between 25 and 27. Obviously, the more spin rate on those breaking pitches, the better, because those breaking pitches aren't as affected by the altitude as the four-seam fastball is, or fastballs in general. So overall, that slider with the break is nice, very, very nice tool to have in the toolbox. The MLB average is 2,500 RPMs on the slider, and that slider should be thrown about 23% of the time. The changeup should be thrown about 84 to 87 with a spin rate of less than 1,700, somewhere between 1,500 to 1,700 wouldn't be terrible. MLB average is 1,600 for that pitch, roughly. And that pitch should be thrown about 17% of the time. Lastly, the curveball is the breaking pitch that I don't want my ideal Coors Field pitcher to throw. But again, it depends on the situation. The curveball that I'd like my ideal Coors Field pitcher to throw would be somewhere in the range of 79 to 82 miles an hour with a spin rate of over 2,500 RPM, right? MLB average is about 2,500 RPM, 2,571 to be exact. That pitch really wouldn't be thrown a ton. The usage rate would only be about 5%. In terms of a guy like Connor, who really does not fit this mold in terms of usage rate, in terms of his velocity, it's important for him to just utilize what works. And what apparently looks like it would work would be his curveball. Again, 105 batting average against. On top of that, the spin rate he gets on those pitches is 2,600 RPM. That's really good spin rate for a curveball. So he's got elite spin rate in terms of his curveball, and he doesn't throw it. So I think, again, for a guy like Seabold, who doesn't fit the ideal mold of a Coors Field pitcher, taking a page out of Kyle's book and making that curveball your number one breaking pitch might actually benefit Seabold in the long term and give him a higher likelihood of success at Coors Field. That was player number one. I think I forgot to play the sound.
Player number one.
Seabold was player number one. So with that, we will transition into player number two.
Player number two.
I do promise I will get better at managing all these sounds as the course of this podcast goes along. But pitcher number two, pitcher-player number two, I guess, is Peter Lambert. Mr. Lambert has a very, very interesting story. He was one of the more highly regarded arms in the Colorado Rockies system over the last few years or so. But then he had that whole thing with Tommy John surgery, which took him out of professional baseball for a whole season. And now he's kind of back and working his way back into pitching consistently. He was originally a starter. He got some time as a reliever, but I think in the minors thus far this season, he has been used as a starter primarily. He's got five games in AAA thus far this season. He started all five. He's 0-2 with a 4.73 ERA in 13 innings pitched. He's walked 9 and struck out 13. But my friends, that was at the minor league level. The Rockies promoted Peter to the major league roster last week, and he's kind of filled the role of long relief. That's a long relief role that's kind of been vacant since Seabold was thrust into the starting rotation and since Ty Block was designated for assignment a few weeks ago. So Lambert's job is indeed long relief. So far in his long relief role, he's been pretty good. he's been pretty good. He's 0-1, but he has a 2.35 ERA in 7.2 innings pitched. He's walked 2. He struck out 11. Good for an ERA plus of 220. 120 percentage points better than the average MLB pitcher thus far this season. He's got a 2.91 FIP and a 0.78 WHIP. All right, pretty interesting. Now, let's go ahead and take a look at this Peter Lambert. They don't actually have percentile rankings for him for 2023 as of yet because he hasn't thrown enough innings. He's only thrown 7.2. I'd expect him to show up on those percentile rankings within the next few weeks or so as he undoubtedly gets more usage. Let's note first off that Peter's only 26. So he's a guy that who can continue to develop over the course of the next few years with the organization, and they can kind of just fit a mold for him and find him a role that actually works, because he definitely has a base for a guy who could succeed in Coors Field. Let's go take a look at his pitch distribution. So far this season, he's working about 5 pitches, well, 4, but a different variation of 1. We'll see that in a second. He's thrown a fairly balanced percentage of pitches so far this season. With the changeup, he's thrown the changeup 33% of the time at about 86 miles an hour. He's thrown the four-seam fastball 32% of the time at 94 miles an hour. He's thrown 2 variations of the slider. There's a 2 variation pitch. He's thrown a slider and a sweeper. Now, for those of you who don't know what a sweeper is, neither did I until very recently when apparently lots of major league pitchers started throwing it, and I was like, okay, what is this whole sweeper nonsense about? Like, I've never heard about this before in my life. So I looked it up. A sweeper is apparently just a slider that sweeps more laterally than a conventional slider would. So more lateral movement, less downward movement. That's what a sweeper is. And Peter's thrown 2 of them. He's thrown both the slider and the sweeper in about the same capacity. He's thrown the slider 18% of the time, the sweeper 15% of the time. The slider is about 88 miles an hour, and the sweeper is about 83 miles an hour. Lastly, he's thrown a curveball. He's only thrown the curveball about 2% of the time. He's thrown 2 of them, a whole 2 pitches, a whole 2 curveballs, and that pitch averages about 76. Not too shabby. If I remember correctly from the last few seasons when Peter's been healthy, the curveball was regarded as one of his better pitches. All in all, Peter Lambert is very interesting. So far, the consensus on him, obviously in the limited sample size of innings that he's pitched, is that he is a very solid pitcher. The interesting thing to note about Peter thus far is that he's worked a very effective changeup fastball combination, a lot like Brent Suter has, obviously not in the same regard because Peter throws harder. Overall, that changeup fastball combo has been very effective for him, but it's interesting to see how ineffective his slider has been, and that's kind of a point of concern. Obviously, when you don't throw a ton of curveballs, you would like your slider to be effective. Neither the slider or the sweeper have been. The batting average against on the slider for Peter thus far this season is .333 with an expected batting average of .403. His sweeper has a batting average against of .500, but an expected batting average against of .239. So, I mean, take it as you will. The sweeper technically should be better than his slider, but again, it's just a very, very fine line. And all in all, the fact that he's been able to rely on that changeup fastball combination so far this season to be effective is very, very promising. At least that's what the eye test would tell me as well. He gets counts started off effectively with fastballs, which is good to see. And then later on in the counts, I've seen him get a lot of swing and miss on changeups. And that's encouraging. But again, the slider has been frequently mislocated. I think in the Red Series, he middled a slider first pitch to, it was Nick Senzel, I believe, who hit a home run off of that pitch. Not good to see. And that's not the only instance. He's gotten away with it a few times, which is probably why that on the sweeper, his expected batting average is a little bit lower, because the sliders he's thrown that are actually sliders, they haven't really been very good. So I think the sweeper is kind of just his way of counteracting a slider that hasn't been amazing. Even the sliders he's thrown, like I said, that have gotten swings and misses have occasionally been in very, very poor locations. I'm thinking very specifically back to last week where he pitched against the Pirates and hung an absolute middle high slider to Ke'Bryan Hayes, who swung right through it. Even though he was on it timing wise, swung right through it. So, I mean, he's getting lucky. We'll be back in just a second. Stay tuned. Welcome back. So, picking up where we were with Peter Lambert, we were discussing how, despite his effective changeup fastball mix so far on this young season, he's been ineffective in terms of slider usage, and that might cause him problems throughout the rest of the year, considering he doesn't really throw his curveball a ton. So overall, the adjustment that I would make if I were Peter would be to use the slider a little bit less and trust the fastball changeup combo more. Because again, you look at the distribution here of these pitches, the slider and sweeper are effectively the same with minimal difference. He's effectively throwing the three pitches that he throws the most at about the same rate. I think you could easily see that fastball go up to about 45-50% and see something similar with the changeup, maybe at about 35%. That right there would mean a reduction in slider usage, but ultimately it would make his slider a little bit more surprising when he does throw it in the at-bats that he does throw it in. I would like to see him use it a little bit later on in counts rather than to start the count. You don't want to start a count with your least effective pitch, right? So I think starting off counts with that fastball or that changeup, and then maybe throwing in a slider when the changeup has already been utilized during the course of the at-bat might be a course of action. Some metrics we'll monitor with Peter will be the batting average against, obviously, just overall on those pitches with the 333 batting average against on the slider and the 500 batting average against on the sweeper. We'll also monitor the expected batting average against as well to see if those change in any meaningful regard. I don't think I mentioned metrics to monitor for Connor Siebold earlier, actually. The metrics we'll monitor with Siebold will be the curveball usage percentage to see if he's using his curveball more instead of the slider. And we'll also monitor his fastball batting average against. That was a little bit higher than we would like it to be. And the changeup exit velocity as well. Unfortunately, that's another thing that I didn't mention in terms of Connor Siebold. His changeup, for whatever reason, has the highest exit velo surrendered of all his four pitches. People hit his changeup harder than they hit his fastball. That doesn't really make a ton of sense. So hopefully that changeup exit velocity comes down for Connor. And again, in terms of Peter Lambert, we'll just be monitoring whether that slider batting average against reduces, as well as the sweeper batting average against and the expected batting average against for both of those pitches, respectively.
Player number three.
Player number three is going to be Jake Bird. So Jake's role for this team has kind of varied. It's varied over the course of the year for a few reasons. Number one, he was probably going to start the year in Triple A, I believe was the plan, if someone else hadn't gotten hurt. I think there was an injury issue. I don't remember what it was, but Jake Bird was not. Oh yes, it was Bard. Daniel Bard started the year on the IL with anxiety, and that meant that we needed an additional right-handed reliever. Jake Bird was supposed to start the year in AAA, and we ended up just promoting him to the major league roster once the decision that Daniel Bard would be put on the 15-day IL was eventually made. But we've come a long way since then. Jake Bird has become one of the most effective relievers in the Colorado Rockies bullpen. Now, again, I know for a fact that I've been wrong on this so far. I didn't think Jake would be able to be successful given the way he's utilized his pitches earlier in the year. I think his fastball, which was originally noted as a sinker of sorts, wasn't really moving like a sinker. It was moving more like a four seam, which was very frustrating because over the course of his career, his very young career, mind you, Jake Bird had thrown a lot of sinkers. And to see him start the year off with us a more four seam looking fastball gave me a lot less hope in his abilities to be an effective pitcher. But as the season's gone on, Jake has gotten better and his sinker has actually started to look more like a sinker. And it's resulted in the pitcher that we are looking at right now as one of the more effective late inning relievers for the Colorado Rockies so far this season. He is 0-0 with a 2.79 ERA in 29 innings pitched. He's walked 10 batters, struck out 30. Good for a 1.79 ERA plus, a 2.92 FIP, and a 1.14 WHIP. So let's go take a look at Mr. Bird and how he's doing so far this season percentile-wise. Percentile-wise, he's in the lot. He's in the red in a lot of important categories. Most of the categories, he's in the red. A few of these, you could take it as you will. Like, for instance, he's barely in the red in average exit velo. He's effectively major league average at 51st percentile. Expected ERA, expected weighted on base, expected batting average against, expected slugging, barrel percentage, strikeout percentage are all firmly in the red. He's above major league average. Walk rate, he's just above major league average in the 53rd percentile. And in the blue, he's really only in the blue in hard hit percentage, whiff percentage, and chase rate. So overall, he's been a very, very good pitcher. Even though he doesn't get a lot of swing and miss, he's been very effective. So let's go take a look at the pitches that Jake is using so far in 2023. As I mentioned briefly earlier, he is using what is referred to as a sinker, even though it hasn't looked like a sinker for most of the season until recently. He throws that sinker 61% of the time at 94 miles per hour. He throws a curveball 20% of the time at 81 miles an hour. He throws a cutter 19% of the time at 90 miles an hour. And he throws a changeup like 1% of the time at 88 miles per hour. So all in all, solid build for Jake Bird. It's a very unique build for sure, because obviously in my ideal pitcher build, I don't have a pitcher that throws a sinker or a cutter on that build list. And that's for a reason. It's because it's really hard to find pitchers who can effectively throw those pitches. Like, save Corbin Burnes, who won a Cy Young in 2021, using the cutter-sinker combination very effectively. If you only throw one of those pitches, it really isn't worth a ton. I mean, that's not something that's hard to pick up on unless you throw it really, really well, which is like 5% of pitchers. So if you're going to go out and look for a guy who's going to be an ideal pitcher at Coors Field consistently in the long term, you're not going to look for a guy who's in that top 5%, because that's going to require a lot of scrutinization, more so than just finding a guy who can effectively control and command a four seam. Overall, though, Jake has been very, very effective at using this sinker-cutter combination. The only pitch he's not throwing very well is that changeup, and he's only thrown two of them, and it has a 1,000 batting average against. So there's a reason he's only thrown two. The three pitches he throws the most, the sinker, curveball, and cutter, have all been very good. The highest batting average against on any of those individual pitches is that sinker, which he throws most of the time, so it might be expected. But a 283 batting average against with an expected batting average against of 268, I don't know. I don't think you can complain about that if you're a Colorado Rockies fan or if you're a part of the Colorado Rockies organization and looking for a solid late inning reliever like Jake Bird is. Overall, I think the consensus on Jake is that he is a very good reliever, one of the better relievers on the team. He effectively uses that sinker cutter combo, and that curveball is absolutely deadly. We're talking 2,850 RPMs deadly. Like, that thing moves. It has a batting average against of 0.033 with an expected batting average against of 0.066. That pitch is easily his best pitch. 20 of his 30 strikeouts have come on the curveball. So all in all, he's definitely developing into a really, really good pitcher. And as I said, the sinker has really gotten better over the year. It's less flat and four-seam-like, and it's starting to move more like a sinker. I don't know if that's because he changed something with his technique or altered something with his grip. Whatever it is, it's looking more like a sinker with that arm side run, less so like a four-seam fastball, which is just more straight with less arm side run. All in all, I think the only adjustment that Jake could really make to make himself a more effective pitcher would be to throw that cutter more. Like I said, a guy like 2021 Corbin Burnes really effectively utilized that sinker-cutter combination. Even though Corbin kind of had both of those pitches in the same ballpark velocity-wise in the upper 90s, I don't think Jake necessarily needs to throw either in the upper 90s. Obviously, Jake throws his sinker at 94, his cutter at 90. That should be effective enough to the point where if he balances out the sinker and the cutter ratio in terms of how much he throws them, maybe throwing the sinker about 50 to 55% of the time and throwing that cutter about 20 to 25% of the time, making those pitches more balanced in your repertoire are going to make you a better pitcher all in all, because again, those are pitches that counteract each other. Like, you throw the sinker, it has arm side run. The cutter has away run, or it runs away from the pitcher's arm side. It's like a slider, but it's a little bit harder with a lot more fastball like movement out of the hand. So I think balancing those two, using that cutter more for Jake, would probably be more effective. Metrics that we'll monitor with Jake throughout the course of the season are obviously going to be that cutter usage percentage and the sinker batting average against, to see if he can continue to maintain that 0.283 batting average against. And if he indeed does start using that cutter more, if that actually brings his sinker batting average against down, who knows?
Player number four
is Randall Grichuk. Now, Randall Grichuk was traded from Toronto over the last offseason, I believe it was 2022. We traded Raimel Tapia, maybe another prospect, over to Toronto for Randall Grichuk. We were looking for a guy who could put the ball in the air more than Raimel Tapia could. And I think all in all, it's been fairly solid. Grichuk gave us, I think, about 20 home runs last year, batted like 250 something. But his current role on the team in 2023 has been mostly as a platoon outfielder. Obviously, he started the year on the IL. He was going to be a contributor to this major league team at one point in time or another. And that whole jam in the outfield just needed some addressing. And overall, I think once we signed Profar, there were just a lot of bats that were going to be needed to move around. Jonathan Daza is obviously not on the team anymore, but Brenton Doyle ended up taking his place and has been very deserving of playing time. Like, the kid is incredible in all aspects of the game, offensively, defensively, what have you. Randall Grichuk kind of fits into a role where he can play any outfield position depending on who needs a break in any given day or for any given matchup. So he's kind of played left when Brenton Doyle has played center. He's played center when Jerkson Profar is in left. And for the most part, he's batted somewhere between fourth through seventh in the lineup. I think that fits the type of player that he is offensively best. He's also seen some action in the two hole, which I thought was a little bit aggressive on behalf of Buddy, just because I think Randall does better in a situation where he needs to get runners in and score guys with base hits rather than try and get on base to build a rally, because he's not a super huge base stealing threat, even though he has a stolen base thus far this season. Overall, his stats for the season look like this. He's played 13 games. He has a home run. He's knocked in three runs. He's slashing .340 batting average, a .411 on base, and a .911 OPS. He's walked six times, struck out 13 times. Good for an OPS plus of 135. No errors committed on defense. And like I said, he has the stolen base, hasn't been caught stealing yet. Overall, the analytic pros for Grichuk have been his .360 batting average against on fastballs, which he sees 55% of the time. Look, there's no doubt that Randall, coming off of the injured list, has one goal in mind, and that is to swing the bat. He has made significant adjustments to his stance, to his technique, and he really wants to use them. It's very apparent. He's taken lots of hacks, and that .360 batting average against, or batting average, because he's a hitter, not a pitcher, the .360 batting average on fastballs is very encouraging, since that's the pitch he sees most of the time. Unfortunately, his desire to swing has really kind of cost him in terms of off-speed and breaking balls. His lowest batting average is against off-speed pitches, and he struck out the most on breaking pitches that he's seen. The consensus so far on Grichuk is probably this. He's a solid contact guy who has that power potential. He doesn't always use it the most because he does see a lot of those breaking pitches and off-speed pitches in important counts. People aren't just going to throw him fastballs when they know he's going to rack them, which he has so far this season. But his struggles to adjust to the secondary pitches have kind of limited his abilities to perform with certain situations, like to get a rally started, to get on base. So he whiffs a ton. And this is what the eye test that I've been using would suggest. He swings a ton at breaking pitches outside the zone and off-speed pitches low and in. So that struggle to adjust from sling mode to I need to protect leaves him whiffing very helplessly at pitches just because it looks like he's come up with the intention to swing. And in certain counts, he seems like he's just decided before even seeing the pitch that he's going to do his best to swing, even if the pitch is nowhere near the zone. So he's kind of fallen into an issue that CJ Cron fell into during like week two or week three of the season, where he's just kind of helplessly whiffing at pitches, mostly breaking pitches and off-speed pitches. So I say really the only adjustment for Grichuk to make is to refine his approach and stay focused and limit the amount of pitches that he chases outside of the zone. That's going to end up, well, I guess that's pretty good advice for most of the lineup in general, but for him specifically, just the fact that he is seeing fastballs so well right now, he needs to make pitchers throw them. He needs to make pitchers throw him fastballs because he will absolutely rack them. That will improve the power numbers. The exit velo is already fairly high for Randall so far this year on fastballs, 94 miles per hour average exit velo. He's pretty much averaging a hard hit baseball on fastballs. So I think if he refines that approach and stays focused, he'll be able to be more effective at the dish in whatever spot in the lineup that he's placed into on any given night. The metrics we'll monitor with Grichuk will be his whiff percentage on breaking pitches and off-speed pitches to see if that goes down. Currently, he's whiffing 49% of the time on breaking balls and 50% of the time on off-speed. So that's obviously going to have to go down if he's going to want to continue to maintain his above-average hitting that he started 2023 with this season.
Player number five
is our good friend Ryan McMahon. Ryan McMahon is a guy I've wanted to get into for a long while, and for whatever reason, he's kind of just skipped my mind because other guys have been towards the top of my mind, and I've just been like, all right, we need to talk about them. It's high time we talk about Ryan McMahon. Ryan McMahon is one of the more interesting guys on this team in that you want to love him, but he does things that makes you not want to love him, if that even makes sense. But we'll get into it. Overall, Ryan McMahon has kind of shifted his role as the season has progressed. He started the season off as pretty much the everyday second baseman after Brendan Rodgers got hurt in spring training, and Ilaris Montero didn't start the season off as well and as disciplined at the plate or defensively as the Rockies would have liked him to. He didn't really start off terribly at the plate. He did strike out a lot to start the season, but it was more so defensively that he was a liability. He ended up getting sent down, and McMahon shifted over to his regular position of third base, and he's now the primary third baseman for this team on most nights. So far in 2023, it's been kind of a mixed bag for Mac. 42 games played, he's hit 4 home runs, he's got 18 RBIs with a slash line of .215 batting average, .289 on base percentage, and a .678 OPS. He's walked 16 times, he's struck out 54 times, which I do believe is like top 5 in all players in Major League Baseball, unfortunately. He's got a 74 OPS plus, that is 26 percentage points worse than the average MLB hitter. He's stolen 3 bags, gotten caught stealing 3 times, and he's made 1 error. Overall, we can go look at the percentile rankings for McMahon. He ranks pretty solidly in the red in a few of these categories. Average exit velo, he's solidly in the red at 80th percentile. Max exit velo, he's in the 89th percentile. Hard hit percentage, he's in the 78th percentile. Barrel percentage, he's in the 82nd percentile. Chase rate, he's in the 76th percentile. Walk rate, he's in the 58th percentile. And expected slugging, he's in the 64th percentile. So he's in the red in a lot of these categories, but unfortunately, the categories that he's in the blue are not going to be very beneficial for him. Expected batting average, he's in the 22nd percentile. Strikeout percentage, he's in the 6th percentile of Major League Baseball. Whiff percentage, he's in the 31st percentile. And to couple that, his outs above average haven't been amazing. He's in the 30th percentile there. Sprint speed is in the 22nd percentile. And arm strength, he's roughly average. So all in all, you look at Ryan McMahon and you say, yeah, there's definitely some potential here. I could definitely see him being a solid major league player. And I mean, you could even look back to his minor league career and come to that conclusion, because he's been a very solid player throughout his professional career. His entire minor league career saw him finish with a career batting average of .297 with a .366 on base percentage and an .878 OPS. That's a pretty good hitter. And he only hit 90 home runs throughout the five or so seasons, six-ish seasons that he spent in minor league baseball. But over the course of his minor league career, he's been around a 2.8 strikeouts per walk kind of guy. So he's been a guy who only walks about every three times he strikes out. This season, he's up more around 3.4 strikeouts per walk. So that's a little bit higher than you'd like to see. But I think ultimately for McMahon, it all rests in his technique. Overall, he is a struggling hitter, and that is very apparent. Like I said this even on the preview episode for the year, he struggles to hit pitches up in the zone, specifically fastballs. And his whiff rate on fastballs is absolutely, it's really not terrible, actually. It's at 26%, but 26 strikeouts on fastballs is not good for a major league hitter. He's got a .235 batting average on fastballs, and the expected batting average on fastballs for him is .229. That's not good for a major leaguer. At a very minimum, to be a major league hitter who's in the lineup consistently, you have to be able to hit fastballs. That's just a must. And Mac has been unable to do so. But why has he been able to do Obviously, in his minor league career, he's been able to hit fastballs, right? You don't bat .297, pretty much .300, being unable to hit the pitch that most pitchers throw most of the time. But I think, like I said, the issue for Mac rests in his technique. So what I did is I went back to 2018, which was his first full season as a Colorado Rocky. I went back to 2021, which was his best offensive season as a Rocky. He had like a 98 OPS plus. So his best season has seen him 2 percentage points worse than the major league average hitter. But nonetheless, it's been his best season. And I compared that footage to 2023. So I went back each of those 3 years and took a look at his swing technique, because I can tell over the years that there has been something different. And it's never a good thing when a guy has been messing around with his technique so much over like a 5-year window, where it seems like almost every year he has a different batting stance. Ask Sam Hilliard. Sam Hilliard is now gone. Now, unfortunately, Ryan McMahon has a long contract that Sam Hilliard did not have, so you can't just get rid of McMahon, which is why the Rockies are going to need to fix McMahon in order to make him better offensively and give themselves a reason to keep him in the lineup on a regular basis. Like I said, he is the team's primary third baseman. He is a very, very good defender, and you do want a very, very good defender in your lineup. I believe he finished like top three in Gold Glove voting 2021, I want to say. All things considered, Mac is worth investing in, but he can only be worth investing in if he turns his life around, so to speak, at the dish. And I think he can. Like I've said so far for most of these other Colorado Rockies, the key for them to succeed offensively seems to be opening their batting stance. We've seen this so far this season with guys like Ezekiel Tovar, with Randall Grichuk. That's the most notable adjustment he's made, opening his stance. That's why he feels like he wants to swing, even at pitches he shouldn't. He's swinging more because he feels like he can hit the ball better, because he can see the pitcher better with an open stance. So, I mean, other guys like KB, Elias Diaz have all benefited from opening their stances a little bit more thus far this season. Mac already had an open stance, and even with his open stance, he'd been struggling, which is why I was forced to go and look at some of the footage from previous seasons to see how exactly Mac used to set up in the batter's box. So here's what I found. 2018, Mac had a more open stance like he does so far this season, but unlike here in 2023, back in 2018, Mac had a more steep bat angle in that he set up with his bat head faced more towards the ground than upright or flat even. Like this season, Mac kind of waggles it a little bit. He'll get the bat waggle in, but he sets it at about parallel to the ground, maybe a little bit higher before he gets into his load and takes off with the swing. In 2018, he started like, if you can imagine a Paul Goldschmidt, for those of you who have been around and followed Major League Baseball for a while, you know how steep Paul Goldschmidt's batting stance is. Like, his bat is almost pointed towards the ground, it feels like. It's very steep. Very, very steep. And Mac had something similar going with his bat waggle in that his bat waggle was more steep. And then he'd get loaded, and that caused him, with that steep starting point before the waggle, to have a more flat bat through the zone, which gave him a more flat swing, more line drive ability. That was something interesting that I noted when I looked at the 21 footage and saw that, unlike 2018, he wasn't starting his bat as steep anymore. It was more flat like it is today, but his feet were more closed. Not even like more closed, but like completely closed. Like, think Brenton Doyle. I know I've picked on Brenton Doyle's stance previously on this podcast because he's very, very closed off. And I hate closed off stances just personally. Nothing against the guy. Obviously, he's a major league baseball player, so he's clearly had success with it. But just something about the closed stance is annoying. But McMahon in 2021, when he had his best offensive season, was effectively a major league average hitter, had a very closed off stance. And it allowed him, even with the flatter bat angle, to get more lifts on the ball, I guess. I think that was a year he hit like 23 home runs or something like that. So Mac has evolved his stance from being open with a steep bat in 2018 to, in 2021, he's more open with a flatter bat. Unfortunately, in 2023, he has almost the worst of both worlds, where he has the open stance that he had from 2018 combined with the flatter bat angle from 2021, and he's more hunched over. He's not standing as straight up as he was in 2018. All in all, that's going to make it really difficult to get to those high pitches up in the zone, which is where a lot of the fastballs that he strikes out on are thrown, up in the zone. Whether it's in 2018, where he had the more flat swing allowed him to be able to level out the bat head a little bit easier and get to those pitches up in the zone. In 2021, even though he was more closed off and had a flatter bat, it's still a little bit easier to get to those balls in the zone if you have fast hands, which I do believe Mac has. I think Mac has fast enough hands to be able to get to that pitch up in the zone. But obviously, he didn't think he had fast enough hands to the point where he altered his stance and his swing yet again, to now in 2023, he really doesn't have the ability to hit that high pitch, even if he's expecting it and he's sitting on it. There have been times this season where he struck out on a fastball up and in, and you can just see his reaction. He's like, dang it, I knew it was coming, but like I can't do anything about it. So ultimately, for Mac, the adjustment that needs to be made is he needs to either close his stance more or keep it open while being more upright with a steeper bat angle. So effectively, you got to pick. Like, either revert more to 2021 Ryan McMahon or 2018 Ryan McMahon, but 2023 Ryan McMahon has the worst of both worlds, and it's simply not going to work. Now, I will note that it seems like over the weekend, particularly in the Philly series, I did notice that he might have closed his foot, his front foot, his plant leg, a little bit more initially on his starting stance, and it seems like that helped him a little bit initially. I think he went 2-for-4 in that game on Friday, and that was one of the first things I noticed. I was like, oh, interesting. And then that first pitch of that at-bat, he lined a hard line drive on the ground at Turner, and Turner wasn't able to make the play. So it seems like Mac is taking baby steps towards getting his stance right where it needs to be. All in all, I do think that that's ultimately what it comes down to for McMahon. All right, he needs to just refine his technique. He needs to understand his swing, figure out what's worked best for him in the past, and either revert to what he initially used to get to the major leagues, the technique that he used to bat pretty darn close to 300 throughout 6 years in the minor leagues, or he needs to go back to what he did in 2021, which is staying more closed and allowing his hands to work with that sort of stance rather than whatever he's using now. So the metrics we'll monitor with McMahon throughout the rest of the season will be his fastball strikeouts and his batting average. Obviously, the fastball strikeouts need to come down. Like, 26 of your 54, is that what I said? 54 strikeouts that are on fastballs, that can't happen. That can't happen if you're going to be a consistent hitter at the major league level. And I think Mac knows that, and I think he's taking steps to do that. So it'll be interesting to see if he can reduce those strikeouts on fastballs while simultaneously improving his batting average on not only just the fastballs, but on pitches that are thrown his way in general whenever he's in the lineup. All right, we'll summarize these players and conclude this episode coming up next. Stay tuned. Welcome back, y'all. So in conclusion, the summary that we can take away from the guys we discussed on this episode is that the Rockies find themselves in a few tricky situations. Firstly, they have a few pitchers on the roster right now who are contributors in major ways that don't fit the ideal mold of a successful Coors Field pitcher in the long term. And as such, they need to focus more on using those guys' effective pitches more often than not. So rather than having a Connor Siebold throw a slider that has been very ineffective for much of the season, consistently as he has been throughout the season, using that curveball more, the pitch that has been his most effective secondary pitch, even in a limited sample size, will probably lead to more success, especially considering he has above average spin rate on that pitch. And a guy like Kyle Freeland, who also doesn't necessarily fit the mold of a successful Coors Field pitcher, has found success utilizing his curveball. So finding those adjustments that don't really align with what ideally should be the case, especially considering the league is moving more towards using sliders than curveballs just as a whole, adapting to the needs of the pitchers that are on staff in the rotation is more important, so we can get the best out of those guys rather than develop them into something that might not necessarily, even at maximum potential, be enough to succeed consistently in the long term given the circumstances of playing at altitude. Secondly, in terms of hitters, the Rockies hitters need to refine their approach to off-speed and breaking pitches just across the board. They've done a much better job of it over the last few weeks, which is why they've all of a sudden climbed back to six games within 500, and they've kind of just stepped up their game in terms of offensively. But overall, they just need to continue to refine that approach, find ways to fight off those off-speed pitches and breaking pitches. Those pitches don't need to be racked. They just need to be hit, and hit as hard as possible. I should probably say hit as hard as reasonable, because again, you don't need to hit a home run on every single breaking pitch you see. You take a home run swing on a breaking pitch that you weren't expecting, but recognize out of the hand, a lot of the time that simply just results in a pop-up because you're not able to make that adjustment on the fly. If you believe that you can anticipate when an off-speed or a breaking pitch is coming, obviously by all means, go ahead and sit on it. But again, stick with that fastball, continue hitting fastballs well, and I think that will be the approach that serves you well throughout the course of the season. And the last takeaway, I think, is that Ryan McMahon is fixable. I've heard a lot of calls from Rockies fans over the last few weeks through several drop boxes for experts and analysts, where I've seen people very concerned about Ryan McMahon and even asking if we could trade him or DFA him. I think Ryan McMahon is fixable. I don't know if Ryan McMahon believes he is fixable. I think the signs suggest that he does believe he is, because when he's been interviewed recently about his struggles at the dish, he seems to think that he's missing pitches that he should be hitting. And I totally agree. I think he has shown in the past that he can hit the pitches that he's not hitting. I just don't think with his current technique and setup, he will be able to do so. So I'm really hoping that the hitting coaches, Hensley and the rest of that staff, can work with him and figure out what's worked with him in the past and figure out a way to make it work for him now here in 2023. Overall, thank you for listening to this episode of Adjusting for Altitude. If you have made it this far, your listenership is very, very appreciated. And if you enjoyed this episode, go ahead and share it with your friends, your family, or anyone else who might be a fan of Major League Baseball or the Colorado Rockies specifically. Thank you once again, and I'll see you all next week. Stay safe, stay cool, and go Rockies.
This has been Adjusting for Altitude with Christopher Nelson II. If you are indeed a fan of Colorado Rockies baseball or simply a fan of MLB content, follow this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform and share this podcast with your friends and family. Baseball in Colorado is a complicated situation, but it is certainly not unsolvable. Until our next episode, take care and go Rockies.